there. Welcome to In Full Color, a podcast on race, community, and justice. I'm Taylor McGee, your host. And today I'm talking to Megan Pendleton, a Black queer educator and doctoral student from Baltimore, Maryland. Megan shares her coming out experience and how she got involved in higher education. She talks about her connection to spoken word and how this has impacted her personal and professional life. Hope you enjoy. All right, so to start off, could you please tell me who you are, what you do, and how do you identify racially and or ethnically?
Yes, so my name is Megan Pendleton. I currently work in higher education, specifically working with LGBT students, and I identify as Black, and I use she and her pronouns.
Awesome. And so I would love to hear more about your background and your upbringing. And if you're comfortable, I would love to know about your coming out process and how you navigated being situated within so many intersectional identities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am from Baltimore, born and raised in Baltimore, still heavily identify with being from that area of the country, and was raised in a really tight-knit family, I'd say decently sized family. So I have two younger sisters. My parents, they're still in Baltimore, but then all of my parents' siblings and cousins and everybody is there as well. And so growing up, family was huge for me. And it was, you know, I saw cousins and distant family daily. So that was a big thing. And that is a big part of who I am. In terms of coming out, I think I had a lot of, concerns, I would say, or just a lot of anxiety around what that would mean for me in the family, right? So because family was so huge, how would that influence and how would that show up? I had one out family member. So I had a cousin who was maybe 7 or 8 years older, and another older member of my family who wasn't necessarily really out. And so I feel like when I was coming out or coming to understand who I was, I kind of leaned on that one cousin to just kind of show me the ropes in some way. So I think she was one of the first people who I was I think I might like girls. I think I might like women and trying to understand that piece. And so I think it took me a really long time to come out, really accept it, whatever it was that I was feeling. And then sharing that with, my parents at some point. My dad just kind of asked me, I had been hanging out with my then girlfriend for a whole summer. And, you know, he just kind of asked what was going on. And I knew that he had some particular views about it and based on religion and, you know, wasn't cool with it. And so it was a little awkward for a while, for a few months. You know, I had that conversation with my mom as well. It was a little awkward, but I also had support of a different cousin who I had come out to, and, you know, she was older, probably around my parents' age. And she kind of allowed me the space to ask questions and do some of that different stuff. And so I think it was, for all intents and purposes, it was a very, a really seamless or really kind of a good coming out experience, sort of that initial one. Granted, there was some rockiness there for a little bit, but it wasn't, you know, I was always safe. I was always well, I was always taken care of. And unfortunately, we know that's not the case for so many people.
Sure.
And I remember when I did first come out, one of the things my mom was talking about was, you know, you're already Black, you're already a woman. I just don't want you to have to deal with so much more. And, you know, I got that to an extent. I was, you know, 17, 18. And I understood it, but I think now as an adult looking back, I think I understand her concern, the fear that she had, and, you know, how the world was gonna treat me.
Yeah, totally. How, you kind of touched on this and how you kind of confided in different family members, but mm-hmm. how did that, I think there comes a point when you enter like pre-adulthood or just like the beginning phase of adulthood, of once you start to kind of carve your own path and step away from the comfortable kind of spaces, yeah. you start to recontextualize and reinterpret who you are and like how you belong in the world. And so I guess once you were outside of your family network, whether that was like geographically or otherwise, how did that kind of, or did it change your own perception of yourself? And did you kind of encounter different questions or challenges or anything mm-hmm. like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it definitely did. So I went to a small school up in Pennsylvania, which is, I think, a little bit bigger now, Lehigh University, which was about 3 hours from Baltimore. And I went there for college. And so I think, you know, college is always a really cool time for folks to kind of reinvent themselves or feel like I can really settle into this particular part of my identity, or nobody knows me here, so I can, you know, just kind of show up and be. So I think during that time, I was really eager to find specifically more queer folks, and more queer folks who were like me. So either Black folks or folks of color. I think I was also very scared. Like, I remember one weekend on campus just feeling like I had like binged watched the L Word that weekend. So I'm kind of dating myself, but binge watched the L Word. And the Monday after that, you know, watching that series, I was like, I'm the only gay person on this campus, and like, I gotta figure something out. And so, you know, looked up some stuff and found that there was like a small group on campus for LGBT folks. Reached out, and they were like, unfortunately, the group is like kind of discontinued. It's not really happening. You know, you can come and talk to me. And so this person, her name was Tara Frank. She worked in like the student involvement office, and she like became my mentor because it was like an adult in like a position of, I guess I would say position of power, but an adult at college who was like, hey, this is totally fine. Like, this is totally okay. And like, she really began, really helped to facilitate my understanding of one, myself, but like my involvement in campus and my engagement and things like that. And I think after some time, I became more comfortable and every now and then would venture into the Rainbow Room, which was like the equivalent of like an LGBT center. So would venture into there, but still felt dissonance. And so there was a Rainbow Room, there was a multicultural office, and there was the Women's Center. And so I found myself kind of bouncing in between those three spaces, but feeling like, you know, when I was in the multicultural center, like, you know, my identity is like queer I felt tension there. You know, when I was in the Women's Center, there weren't always a lot of folks of color. And then when I was in the Rainbow Room, there were like very rarely a ton of other folks of color. And so I just kind of felt like I was kind of like piecemealing, you know, sort of mm-hmm. myself and my experiences. But I think as it related to connecting with family, I shared some of the ways that I was involved that weren't necessarily related to like identity. So I was an orientation leader for several years. So, you know, I shared that piece or other things that weren't as connected because I was still trying to figure that out and, you know, determine that for myself. While I was in a long distance relationship with my partner who was also at college. And so it was just a very, very eye-opening and exciting, but also just kind of, you know, weird at moments experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like there's a lot, especially now, a lot of conversation about what like queerness looks like in Black communities. And you have like this emergence of, I think after Moonlight and just around that time, a lot was coming to the forefront about how issues related to coming out and queer identity and all these other things became like trying to unpack a lot of the kind of preconceived notions that exist in the Black community about that. And so what kind of cultural messages were you getting across just like growing up, but also once you entered more diverse spaces where you were just talking about how like, okay, in this one space, like there weren't really a lot of people of color, or in this other space, it was a different makeup. So what kind of like cultural messages were you getting, and how did that impact yourself?
I think growing up, it was, you know, I felt like I always got the narrative of like, you know, you are kind and respectful and, you know, to people regardless of who they are and how they look and all of those things. And then at the same time, I you know, received messages just not directly, but, you know, from hearing conversations, from watching how people responded to certain folks, or like, you know, presumably LGBT folks, that that wasn't okay as well. And so I feel like that was a really interesting space to navigate. It's like, well, wait, I thought we were supposed to be nice and kind and, you know, to everyone, but there's these people for a certain reason that, like, you know, we, you know, they get maybe like a second look, or there's weird conversation about it. And so I think there was definitely some initial tension there about what that meant. And often it was, you know, I think in often it was kind of in like a very like toxic masculinity type of thing. It was like, you know, gay men, or specifically gay Black men, are effeminate and not real men and all those things. And that was a lot of the messaging that I got, and that, you know, gay Black women were hard and butch and, you know what I mean, wanted to be men and hated them. And so realizing that that wasn't the case for me, I think I struggled to feel like, but wait, you know, try to figure out what was the truth. And so I think that was definitely a piece of my just journey, and continues to be, you know, a part of that journey of understanding self and the world and, you know, my place in it. But yeah, I think in college, I didn't have Black queer friends. Like, there was one other Black, there was a Black gay guy in my, like, the same like class, right? The same graduating class. But we weren't very cool, weren't very close, but like, that was it. Like, there were other Black women. Like, I was just it. And so that was also really weird, you know? So, cause it's like, well, I'm at this predominantly white institution. I'm going to hang out with the Black folks, cause like, that's just going to happen. Right. Like, that's where I find the most community. And at the same time, like, I feel like there isn't really a space here for all of me. Right. Or nobody else really gets it. And so definitely finding solace in some like connections with, you know, a few other queer folks of color, but just having to kind of what I felt like swallow certain pieces of myself in different spaces.
Absolutely. I think that's something I struggled with a lot of, like having to compartmentalize my identity in order to fit into different spaces, and trying to, like, even if you're like, parts of yourself are like not always fully expressed, I think I have just learned to recognize that I can still be a whole like person as myself without feeling like so disparate and having so much like cultural dissonance at the same time. And so how for you, how did your experiences as like young Megan in Baltimore, but also entering college and grad school, how did those experiences start to kind of inform your own identity and your professional life, but also the work that you're doing now?
Once I, you know, was toward the end of my time at Lehigh, I felt the most comfortable in my skin as like, oh, okay, cool. I'm a Black, I think I was saying lesbian then. I was like, you know, I'm a Black lesbian woman. That's just it, right? Like, that's who I am. I was felt really good and solid in that. And I had folks who didn't necessarily hold that particular intersection of identities kind of affirm and show up and love on me in some of those ways. And I had found solace in poetry and spoken word. And so I had, you know, started listening and following, a lot of spoken word artists, and I had been performing and stuff at college. And so that really was a great space for me to kind of find and share my voice in terms of what I was thinking and feeling, all of those things. And then when I went to, so I took 2 years in between undergrad and grad school. And when I went to grad school, I was the only Black person in my cohort of 19. And and there were other queer folks. There were maybe three or four other queer folks in the cohort, but they all identified as white. And so, I was in this space where I felt like, you know, what do I have to do to survive this space? And so, I think looking back, I, again, in some ways, kind of swallowed or didn't make, you know, I felt like it was visible, it was clear, right, that I was the only Black person in the cohort. And at the same time, it was like, I need to do what I have to do to fit in here so I can survive these 2 years. And so I would say while my racial identity was salient, I felt like I couldn't really access or navigate it in a certain way. And so all of that to say, you know, as I think about my role in, you know, student affairs and higher education now, it really is to help provide a space for folks who are like me or, you know, have similar identities and things like that, so that I can kind of like pay it forward. So it's like, you know, what can I do to ensure that there's not another, you know, Megan or someone like her who doesn't feel like they have a space where they can kind of really show up fully? And how can I, you know, have conversations with colleagues, or how can I advocate for that? And what did I need, right, when I was in college or when I was in grad school, to kind of show up and do that? So I would say that's one way that it's kind of showing up. And so I'm also in a doctoral program at Colorado State University for higher education leadership. And so a lot of my personal research topics and things like that have been on experiences of queer and trans students of color in higher education, but also more recently looking at experiences of staff. So how are staff members navigating this space? You know, knowing that while on the one hand, right, we're doing this to advocate for other students, to support and uplift, to dismantle some of these problematic systems and institutions, but at the same time, we are in these institutions and we, you know, kind of experience some of the same things that our students may be experiencing. So I definitely think all of that, you know, the little Megan from Baltimore through Lehigh and, you know, UGA at grad school, and now working and grad school again, I think all of those things have influenced you know, what I've chosen to study and why I've chosen to continue on in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of express this dynamic between like Blackness as being like invisible, but also hyper visible, and having, you're not represented, but it's also like so obvious that like you are there and you're an existing in this space that is like not designed for you in a sense. And just from my own experiences, obviously, like I do have light skin privilege, and it's a very different kind of, I live in a very different world than people who are darker skinned and present more Black than I do. But I've also encountered that myself of, there's a certain like salience that happens for being biracial or being Black that kind of supersedes any other aspect of my identity. And it does become like an issue of safety, not even just like just in society, but just in, okay, my class and my friend group. And it's this kind of like fight to survive. And understanding of that. And so when you have like an intersectional identity, I feel like it's this push and pull constantly of what like marginalization is going to be most salient in this space at this time, but then it's going to change at a different point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that is one of the reasons that I really enjoy living in like the Atlanta area. So as much as I don't agree with the politics of this state often or ever really, I think Atlanta in the area is the first place that I had ever been to where I just saw so many Black, queer, and trans folks just in the world, like just working at Target or at Starbucks or, you know, like working at Emory or, you know what I mean? Like just everywhere. Like in, and so it feels, you know, sometimes you want to be in a space where you don't feel like you are like, you know, like an ostrich, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or, it's like, or a peacock, you know, like you don't want to feel like, you know, everybody else, you know, is that you're sticking out. And so that has been, it's been so nice for me. And as much, I often think about, my wife and I often think about moving back up closer to my family in Baltimore and all of that stuff. And, you know, while I know Atlanta isn't the only place where there's, you know, a critical mass of queer folks of color or Black queer folks, like this place, it feels really special to me, you know? And it's like, I don't have to worry about some of those things. If I'm going to a specific restaurant or particular part of town, it's like my, you know, the person who's the hostess at the restaurant, the waiter, you know what I mean? Like all of these people. And so it has normalized that for me so much. And that has been really, really refreshing.
Yeah. I think that's something that I forget about a lot because I've grown up in Atlanta my entire life. And I often forget that like there is so much just cultural diversity and it's just people, like you said, just in everyday life. It's just like, okay, this person at Target or like this hostess or whatever. It's just like there. And then I'll go somewhere else and I'm like, oh, like there's Atlanta and then there's Georgia. And they're two very different places and two very different experiences. And what is seen and what is available is very different. And you kind of just touched on it, but I'd love to know more about how your experiences in Baltimore and the North have translated or how they compare to being in Georgia and in the South and how that kind of, because in the beginning you said that like you still identify as being proudly from Baltimore, but like you do live in the South now. And so what is that experience been like? Was it kind of like culture shock or were there just, you know?
I think initially it was culture shock. And even before I moved here, so when I was applying for grad schools, I had gotten into Penn State for their program and University of Georgia. And I didn't get into University of Maryland, which I was really wanted to. And so I was really worried about what it meant to move to Georgia. You know, I think we hear a lot of rhetoric about the South and about what that means to be a Black person and a Black woman. And, you know, I felt like I heard a lot about like, you know, the overt racism and moving to the Bible Belt and all of these things. And so I was definitely scared. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I was very nervous about what that was gonna look like. And I think moving from Baltimore, like a pretty decently sized city, pretty big city, to Athens, Georgia, which is very, you know, small college town, a bit more rural. It was a huge culture shock, just in like the way of life and the pace in, you know, all of those things. And so it was the first time that I saw so many like just kind of like Confederate flags, just, you know, people having them on the back of their cars or, I don't know, just And I think that with some level of like Southern culture or Southern hospitality that you hear about, that I was definitely like, oh, okay, I can kind of see what this is. I don't know if there was something. I definitely think because of the history of racism in the South, right? We know that racism exists in the North as well, although we often try to be like, oh, the North is so progressive and like, you know, there's no racism up there. And it's like, yeah. Yes, there is. There's racism everywhere. Yeah. But I think it was, you know, understanding the particular face of it in the South and in different places. And so I think it, you know, required a level of learning what that looked like. Yeah, I think even now, you know, now that I'm not in Athens, but still in Georgia, I'm just continuously reminded of what it means to be in a red state.
Why did you get involved in education and why are you compelled to work with young people in particular?
Yeah. So I kind of stumbled into higher education and student affairs as many folks do. And so I was, as I mentioned, I was really involved in college. My mentor, Tara Frank, and several other folks who were really like integral in my success at Lehigh were like, hey, you know that you can do this, right? Like you can work in student affairs. And I was like, what is student affairs? I was an environmental engineering major. And so I was like, I have no clue what you're talking about. and so they were like, yeah, you know, like how you're involved in orientation and you do this and you do that. Like we, you know, the advisors, the adults who kind of oversee these groups, you know, we're in higher education. So they were like, you can do this. And I was like, what? Kind of around the end of my junior year, I was like, okay, I don't think I want to do this engineering thing, but you know, I was already 3/4 of the way through. So got that degree, but then, you know, with the support of those folks and my parents, just kind of realized like, okay, there's other things I can do. So in those 2 years between grad school and undergrad, I worked for like an online education company. I did some like research for a mentor. Then I worked at a community college in their student life department for about 6 or 7 months before I went to Georgia. But during those 2 years, just trying to get a sense of like what it is that I actually wanted to do and trying to figure that out. And I knew that I really enjoyed the student affairs thing from the student side, but you know, being involved in orgs and all that stuff, but I didn't really know what that looked like from the other side. And so, you know, after a while, I did some research and I was like, you know, I think this is what I want to do. So my time at Georgia, while very interesting, really helped to solidify that that's what I wanted to do. Then, you know, as I was kind of finishing up my master's program, I was very clear that I wasn't going to do any type of diversity or identity work. And that was unfortunately because of the messages I received around how, you know, if you get into that work, you are pigeonholed, you know, you won't be able to move up, you know, that I would, you know, forever have this mark of diversity work on my, you know, on my resume. And so that was something that I didn't want to do it because of that. Then my first job out of grad school was in the multicultural office at UGA. During that time, I learned a lot. I had some amazing, right? It's like, I'm not going to do this. And then I went and did exactly that.
Psych.
right. Psych. During that time, I had this just, you know, amazing supervisors and amazing staff. Zoe Johnson at University of Georgia and Dora Frias, who was also at UGA at the time, they were my supervisors and were just really dope. Like Zoe was a Black woman, Dora's a queer Mexican woman, and they really helped me to kind of grow in my own identity while also doing the work. And so that time in my life was absolutely transformational. You know, Dora was the first person the first queer woman of color I had worked with, who was a supervisor and who just really validated and affirmed and was like, yeah, like, this is messed up, or, you know, really pushed me in some really great ways. And like, now we're all really good friends. But I think that was kind of the beginning of me really being like, okay, one, I can do this identity higher ed work. And then two, you know, who I am is absolutely okay. And even in a work setting. And that was huge. I mean, they absolutely, you know, transformed things for me. And you know, I'm you know, in identity work again, working with LGBT students, and probably see myself potentially staying here for a while or wanting to do some type of advocacy for marginalized students in higher education. In higher education specifically, is because I love the energy on a college campus. There is nothing for me in the world like it. As a student, it was very cool, but I feel like as a staff member, like, there's always, you know, really cool programs. The students are going to push and challenge you. You know, I'm a bit of a nerd, so I'm like, this just all of this knowledge around, and, you know, the speakers and all of those things. And I feel like college students are just super eager to, I don't know, achieve their goals or push the system and figure out what they want to do. And that's exciting to me. I really love that. So, and like, I like college students. Like, they just, I don't know, it just works well for me. Now, my wife, as I said, she is an elementary school art teacher. While I love children and think they're fantastic, I could never do her job. You know, I just couldn't work with, you know, young babies like that.
It takes patience.
It takes a lot of patience and, you know, a lot of things that I don't necessarily have, and I'm okay with that. But yeah, I enjoy college students. And I think it's because I so vividly remember what it was like to be one.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. I feel like I had kind of an aha moment this past year or so, of like, I don't ever want to do anything with race. I already live this. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to do anything with it. And then life was like, psych, you're going to do this. Sorry, just keep working on it. But I know for me, trying to not be like pigeonholed into becoming like the token like person and like the representative of like all these social issues has been really difficult, especially as a young person who is like pretty involved on campus, and also a very common struggle for a lot of people of color and queer people, and just any person who is a minority in whatever capacity, that I don't just want to like be the poster child or like the token person to represent like a diversity quota.
Yeah, I think it is. I make sure that when I'm talking, like I say, you know, I like to use a disclaimer that, you know, I am not an expert on the experiences of Black queer women. I'm not an expert on the experiences of queer women of color. Like, I'm an expert on my experience, and barely that sometimes, because it's like, wait, do I really know what I think? You know what I mean? You know, I think it's just pushing against that notion that, you know, I have to speak on behalf of XYZ group, and it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And, you know, it's not safe for me to do that. And I feel like that feeds into this narrative that like one person from a marginalized group, you know, can speak on behalf of a community that's, you know, thousands or millions of people deep, you know? So I'm just like, I'm not going to do that. I can share what I know some experiences of other folks are, right? Through doing research, through having connected with and interacted with a bunch of students, I can say, this is, you know, typically what folks share and stuff like that. So it's like, you know, I can share some of that information, but I can also, you know, advocate on behalf of my own experience and on the people that I know, without saying that this is the only experience that this group has, you know? So And I think sometimes in some spaces, because of the work that I do, like because I work in LGBT work, sometimes I am the only LGBT, you know, person in a space, or I am on a committee because I might be able to represent that particular voice on campus or that voice for a student, you know what I mean? And so sometimes I have to step into that and say, okay, no, so this is what, you know, advocate for the needs of LGBT students or something like that. So making sure that I'm kind of aware of those environments and, you know, when I need to show up and speak up for folks, and then when I need to push back against the narrative that, like, I have to do that. So it's an interesting balance, I would say.
I think you've touched on this across our conversation. But how have you woven advocacy and activism into your in your professional work, but also just in your everyday life?
I think a lot of it, you know, since I really started full time in student affairs or started full time in this career, a lot of it has been through the work that I'm doing, you know, in my career. And so a lot of it has looked like, you know, advocacy and supporting marginalized students specifically students of color and queer and trans students. And on the professional side, that's what has looked like. On the personal side, I think it showed up a lot when I was doing a lot of poetry and spoken word. That was a places where I felt safe enough to say how I was feeling, you know, or to express that stuff, or to acknowledge, you know, the BS systems in the world and all of those things. And I feel like now I'm kind of getting back to that, but in a different way, in terms of being in a doctoral program and being able to choose, you know, a research topic and kind of not necessarily become an expert, but become really well versed in a particular topic, one that I'm choosing, you know, to right now it's looking at Black, queer and trans administrators in higher education, but, you know, it's also been a queer and trans people, students of color in higher education. So I think through my research in that way and the work that I'm doing, that is where that advocacy shows up. But I think outside of that, like, I feel like that takes up a lot of mental space for me. And then I think outside of that, like in the world, a lot of the times it's like, I'm just existing. I can't remember who said it, but folks talking about, you know, existence as resistance, you know, so in some ways, I'm not necessarily someone who is going to be at the marches or the rallies or things like that. But, you know, I will donate and I will share things on social media and I will make posts and I'll do some of those things. And so I think it's, you know, been a lot of me acknowledging what my role is and where I feel like I can be most helpful. And that has been via, you know, the sort of career path, but also, you know, through sharing posts and, you know, talking to friends and, you know, some of those smaller scale conversations and things like that.
That's something I have had to wrestle with a lot of trying to, I think, like, as a young person in 2020, like, there's this kind of cultural expectation for you to be somehow socially involved, especially at Emory. It's just kind of like, I feel like most students at Emory are very, like, politically engaged and are very aware of what is happening in the world. And so there's this kind of, like I said, like a cultural expectation for me to, like, show up and always be, like, on the clock to, like, be hardcore activist and to always be saying something and to always have a well-informed opinion. But I had to recognize that I needed downtime because it gets exhausting, because once you get kind of recognized for doing this work, there's this, everyone wants you to keep fulfilling that. And they forget that, like, you yourself are human and you are impacted by the things that you're talking about and advocating for. And I think all of us have different ways of wrestling with those emotions, but also trying to stay grounded and stay humble and rooted. And for me, that's been a lot of just creative outlets and just finding a way to express things either with words that are not like emotionally charged, but they convey a different emotion that's not always on the surface level of like this like Facebook post I'm gonna write about like how I'm feeling right now, but also like, okay, how do I express what I'm feeling without having to use words? And on that, I would love to know more about how you got involved in spoken word and poetry, because I think that is a very sort of, I have several friends who are involved with that too, and I have in the past as well, but I feel like it's a very unique space and a very, the origins of spoken word in particular have been really connected to like revolutionary movements and have been a part of social justice practices for a very, very long time. And so I'd love to know more about how you got involved with that and why you're so connected to it.
Yeah, so I would say, honestly, right now I am the I'm not really as connected as I was in the past. So I think I got involved probably around like middle of high school. I think that's when like Deaf Poetry Jam came out, the show that was on HBO. I think it was on HBO. And it came on late at night, and there were, you know, maybe like 6 to 10 poets who would go up there and slam, and it was so cool. And I found that I was always a pretty shy, rather introverted kid, but I found that when, you know, I could, you know, write a poem or something like that, I felt like I was really, I understood myself the most when I was writing from that place. And so that was really how it started. It was like, this particular outlet helps me make sense of who I am and what I'm doing, and helps me make sense of my feelings and my thoughts. And so that's really how it started. And then I got kind of like deep into it around high school, the end of high school, but definitely in college, and listened to a lot of, or read a lot of, Stacey Ann Chin. She's a Jamaican Chinese spoken word artist who just has this very fiery way that she would deliver her poems. And so I really enjoyed reading and listening to a lot of her work. And so I think that really, that fire, like it gave me some level of permission to be angry about something, or, you know, to express anger in a particular way, or express frustration, or to really kind of express my feelings in a particular way. And so that was always really huge for me. And then while I was in Baltimore, before grad school, I got really involved in their spoken word and poetry scene. And so performed at a bunch of different open mics and did features and stuff like that. And then in grad school, it kind of continued. And so that was awesome. I actually won a contest at Georgia and was able to open up for Maya Angelou when she came to Georgia. It was my 25th birthday, and it was just the most magical thing in the world. It was fantastic. And so that was like life-changing. And I also did a TEDx while I was at UGA about poetry and stuff like that. And so, again, that was years ago. And now I feel like now in my life, I'm just starting to be like, well, maybe I should, you know, pick up the pen again, or, you know, maybe start writing a little bit more, or, you know, kind of get back into it. I've always had a pulse on it, you know, listening to different things, following different artists. But I think now, at this point in my life, I'm like, that might be a really helpful outlet, right? That might be a thing to get back into. And so I've only gone to a couple open mics here in Atlanta, and a few other like shows. But yeah, that was for me, that was the one way I could sort of make sense of myself and the world. And express myself in a way that made sense. So
that's so cool.
So yeah.
How is spoken word poetry translated into your just like everyday life as an educator? Because I think when I've talked with fellow, like some of my other mentors and just even friends who are involved in spoken word, like there's a certain, once you kind of find your own like cadence and rhythm, I feel like that like emotional rhythm translates and just like how you like live and breathe and just like occupy space in the world. And so how's that experience and the kind of outlet that you are able to have with spoken word kind of informed your life as like a Black queer educator?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think it has been huge. I think spoken word requires a level of vulnerability, like a certain level of vulnerability. If you think of really good poems that you've heard, or really good, you know, slams or pieces, there is a level of like, you know, this person kind of cracking themselves open in front of you and letting you see all the messy, bloody, all of that stuff. And I think it is a reminder for me in my work to do that, to focus on, not focus, but to really doing a deep dive and to be reflective into what I'm doing and who I am and how I'm showing up. To really push against sometimes the fear of being vulnerable and things like that. And I think it also translates to and shows up, you know, in my relationship, in my marriage, you know, like sometimes vulnerability can be scary, even in intimate relationships. And sometimes, you know, saying what's on your heart and on your mind it can feel shaky a little bit sometimes. And so I think when I reflect back to, you know, or if I get back into a little rhythm of writing something, I'm reminded of how powerful vulnerability is, where as for a long time in my life, and even sometimes now, you know, kind of contend with feeling like it's weak. And I don't want to be kind of just sort of exposed, but realizing that, you know, in life and especially, you know, in love and my marriage and stuff, like vulnerability mm-hmm. is where it all happens, where the best stuff happens. And so, you know, especially, you know, when you're safe sure. and all of those things, right? You can't just be vulnerable in any space. But I think my connection to spoken word and poetry has definitely influenced that level or that piece of, the work that I do and just kind of how I show That's up amazing. With some love and life.
Wow. My last question for you is, what mm-hmm. advice would you give little Megan in Baltimore, but also mm-hmm. young queer persons of color today on trying to live authentically and embracing vulnerability?
Oh, yeah. I think it's tough because on one hand, like, we know safety is a huge thing, right? We know that, you know, safety for LGBT youth and for queer youth of color is a real thing, and security sure. and housing, all of that stuff is real. And I think where folks are able to safely, you know, just kind of settle into themselves and kind of be okay with who they are. I know it takes a lot of courage and a lot of gumption to do that. And I think that it is, you know, something that I probably wish I would have done a little bit, mm-hmm. but I was scared to death. You know, you're just scared. So it's hard to do that through fear or in the face of fear. But I think like finding mentors, finding those folks. So for me, it was, you know, cousins, and then it was mentors in college, and but finding those folks who get you and where, you know, you can show up and be all of you in their space and in their presence, and they nurture that and they love on you. That was, excuse me, that was pivotal for me. And I think to myself, kind of personally, it would be, you know, just like, just take a deep breath. You know, I feel like I was always very kind of tightly wound and really anxious and all those things. And so, you know, a reminder to kind of take a deep breath, but also, I think, you know, when you're younger, you feel so strongly that who you, I would say for me, I felt really strongly that who I was going to have a huge impact on people. And that was going to, and that was why I couldn't show up in a certain way. So it was a lot of like thinking about and worrying about what other people thought, what they were going to think. And so I would definitely encourage younger me to like not do that, right? It's like people are going to be who they are. Like, you know, if I'm moving through a space and not showing up fully as myself, there are other people who are and like who aren't worried about me. And even if they are, like, that's none of my business anyway. So, yeah, I think I would probably kind of give myself a bit more permission to just go ahead and be who I was, to settle into that and to be a bit more unapologetic. But again, acknowledging that there were very real kind of just fears and uncertainties about how that would show up. And so definitely having people in your corner, finding those folks. And I think just with like, you know, just the way the internet is just sort of this massive, like part of our identity now, there's so much community people can find virtually and so many like experiences and ways that people can tap into folks like them, whether it's through Instagram or TikTok or Twitter or, you know, or something like that. And, you know, using those tools to find your folks. And I think that would probably be great too.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. You can learn more about the project at grayskillmovement.org, and that's gray with an A. And check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter while you're at it. Talk to you soon.